Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Post-Liberalism, Recovering a Shared World, by Fred Dahlmeier, read by Sean Renette. Preface. This book is about a dawning age, when people are with each other more than they are separate from or against each other, when they are dwelling with nature rather than seeking to dominate it, when they are open to a divine promise rather than unleashing doctrinal strife. This age is slow in coming. The obstacles are immense. Hence, recovery is bound to be arduous. In this change, there is no linear progression, no predictable evolution. Although requiring human engagement, there is no cause-effect relation. There is not one thing triggering a single consequence. Rather, everything hangs together and changes together. There is a paradigm shift, a holistic transformation which Martin Heidegger called Ereignis. We are presently in the midst of it. The title, Post-Liberalism, gestures toward this change, without being able to exhaust it. What the title suggests is that Western modernity, which we have traversed during the past 400 years, was in large measure the time of a self-centered and anthropocentric liberalism, an ideology celebrating human autonomy or independence from everything. This view is no longer plausible or tenable. Having become a bit more mature and sober, we have come to realize the relationality or interdependence of everything. Socially and politically, this means we are able, though not always ready, to practice shared public freedom in a relational democracy or commonwealth. The tenor of this book resembles, but in crucial respects also differs from, other publications on the theme. First of all, it radically differs from writings attacking liberalism per se from a certain conservative or Tory perspective. For me, human liberty or freedom is an indispensable axiom of social and political life, especially in an era threatened on all sides by forms of totalitarian rule. In a more nuanced way, my book also distances itself from de Tocqueville's position, with which it shares some accents. As I see it, the basic problem of modern, especially democratic politics for Tocqueville resided in the conflict between liberty and equality. More specifically, between an intact liberal individuality and the danger of populist egalitarianism or massification. What this formulation neglects, in my view, are two things. First, the possibility of an ethical equality, as celebrated by Montesquieu, Dewey, and others, and second, the disappearance under his own eyes of traditional bourgeois individuality due to the onslaught of powerful social and economic forces. Basically, my book takes a more innovative approach. It does not seek to vindicate or glorify the past, but to understand and remedy present conditions. From the angle of the present, the pleasing assumptions of social conservatism simply no longer hold, mainly for two reasons: the rise of financial capitalism and the upsurge of globalization. Under the impact of neoliberal capitalism, the noble individuality of bourgeois times has been completely eroded or even eviscerated, leaving behind only the acquisitive individual concerned with the pursuit of selfish interest. At the same time, globalization has changed the character of the people in a modern democracy, in the sense that democratic equality has to make room for an expanding range of difference and otherness. As a result, the public sphere, or community in contemporary democracy, is challenged or jeopardized by both economic and cultural developments. Here one begins to see the profound predicament of contemporary democracy, the fact that it is embroiled in a stark dilemma or antinomy. Neoliberal capitalism entails the sundering or breaking down of all non-economic social relations. In particular, the policy of deregulation has, as a consequence, the atomization of society into a multitude of competing fragments, pretty much in line with Hobbes's conception of the state of nature, war of all against all. In its wake, however, this atomization leaves a void of meaning beyond the goal of self-satisfaction. Sooner or later, this void has to be filled in order to give people a motive for social participation. As a rule, what fills the need of meaning for people is chauvinistic nationalism or the pursuit of national self-interest. Here we find the roots of liberal or neoliberal totalitarianism, the unification of selfish interests in a nationalist or imperialist agenda. To be sure, in actuality, individual and national interest only coincide in the case of an elite of oligarchs or plutocrats. Here one can also appreciate fully Heidegger's statement in his letter on humanism that self-seeking nationalism is metaphysically on the same page with anthropologism and individual subjectivism. The point of this book is to find a path beyond narrow selfishness and populist nationalism, a path which in broad terms involves the recovery of a shared inter-human space or world. The book takes its departure from the present wasteland of atomization, from the grim condition of neoliberal egocentrism and narcissism. As a first step out of this morass, the text commends a turn to inter-human ethics, especially to Aristotelian ethos, with its emphasis on engaged being and social praxis. From here, the path leads to the tradition of natural rightness, as found in the Hebrew Bible, in Sophocles, and also in Hobbes. Shifting the accent to contemporary politics, the book next explores the viability of liberal socialism as a necessary ingredient of an ethical and justice-seeking democracy, devoid of egalitarianism pressures. From here on, all the following chapters deal with variations or different levels of relationality, seen as an antidote to unilateral selfishness, as will be detailed in Chapter 1. Thus, attention is given to the tensional relation between local and global concerns, under the heading of glocalism, to the relation between reason and faith, as illustrated in the contest between world history and salvation history, and finally to the conundrum of particularism and universal holism and its impact on the meaning of freedom, as well as the prospect of a just world maintenance. As I should add, the search for and recovery of a shared public space or world involves also the recovery of a viable private sphere, free from the stain of unilateral acquisitiveness. In this domain, neoliberalism has been the source of great inner desolation and perversion. Where, one can ask, is there still room for genuine privacy when everything, all traditional public goods, are the target of acquisitive privatization, from schools, parks, and nature reserves, to prisons, police, and private armies? Clearly, privacy has to be emptied or cleansed of all utilitarian traces to emerge again as the reflective mirror of the world. A tall order. A few concluding words. If individual decentering or the debunking of egocentrism is the hallmark of post-liberalism, then I am not so much an author with authority, but a decentered participant in this work. I owe so many debts to so many people that listing them all would require another volume. To be exceedingly brief, let me just mention such close friends as Richard Falk, Ashish Nandi, Tu Wei Ming, and Marietta Stepanians. Closest to me, of course, is my wife Ilsa, with whom I celebrated recently our 60th wedding anniversary. My gratitude to her is immense, as is my gratitude to the rest of the family, children and grandchildren. In terms of gratitude, I should not forget my typist, Cheryl Reed, who has for many years transcribed my difficult handwriting into legible scripts. Readers of this book will no doubt realize my great fondness for poetry and also for music. Perhaps to make their labor easier, readers should keep in the back of their minds some musical scores which permeate all its pages. Beethoven's late quartets, the quartets and quintets of Schubert, but also the dissonant harmonies of more recent composers like Gustav Mahler and Béla Bartók. Here are some lines from Des Knaben Wunderhorn, which Mahler put to music in his Third Symphony. So if you have transgressed the Ten Commandments, then fall on your knees and pray to God. Love only God at all times, so you will gain the heavenly joy. The heavenly joy is a blessed city, the heavenly joy that has no end. Hast du denn übertreten dein Gebot? so vor oft dei Knie und bete zu Gott. Liebe nur Gott in all Zeit, so wirst du erlangen dei himmlische Freud. Dei himmlische Freud ist ein seliger Stät. Dei himmlische Freud, dei keine Ende mehr hat. F.D. Notre Dame, May 2018. 1. Introduction. Liberalism and Democracy. The dominant political ideology today, especially in the West, is called liberal democracy. Taken at face value, the expression suggests a basic synergy and even equivalence of its constitutive terms. A major aim of this book is to show the fragility and, indeed, untenability of this facile assumption. Far from being complementary or mutually supportive, liberalism and democracy in our time are an odd couple, frequently engaged in radical antagonism or conflict. What is the reason or source of this conflict? A simple, perhaps simplified, answer is this. The two partners operate in radically different registers or contexts. While liberalism is located as an orientation or ideology in civil society, democracy is a public structure or type of regime. Since ancient times, it is customary to distinguish between at least three types of legitimate regimes: monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy or republic. Of these, the first two are hierarchically or vertically ordered, invoking a metaphysical warrant for public authority. By contrast, democracy is horizontally structured, invoking only a human warrant. With his deep and correct insight, Montesquieu perceived democracy as a new public paradigm anchored in equality and even the love of equality among citizens. To be sure, democracy also exhibits authority, but the latter cannot be permanent or absolute, and must always be based on the consent or covenant of citizens. In order to avoid domination or bullying, citizens must respect each other as equals, as well as different, and be able to rule over themselves and their ambitions. To show that liberalism is not a public regime, one only has to point to its history. By common agreement, liberalism as a social orientation has its origin in the British Bloodless Revolution of 1688, with John Locke as one of its chief proponents. Although inaugurating a moderate regime change, the revolution did not terminate monarchy, with the result that liberalism accommodated itself to royal Hanoverian authority. Radical public change came with the French Revolution and subsequent revolutions, which terminated the monarchical regime, or reduced it to a ceremonial function. The central motto of the French Revolution was liberty, equality, and fraternity, which means that liberalism was allowed, or meant, to continue, despite the changed public paradigm. Initially, the motto did not seem to be far-fetched. There was indeed a certain synergy between liberty and equality, as was evident in different public factions. As during the Hanoverian period in England, liberty seemed willing to accommodate itself to the new political conditions. However, relations between the partners began to deteriorate steadily during the 19th century. Several factors accounted for this derailment. All of them conspired to push liberalism or individual liberty in the direction of verticality and radical superiority, thus rendering it at odds with democratic equality. Among the prominent factors of the period were social Darwinism, the cult of rugged individualism, industrialization and the erosion of agrarian society, and, last but by no means least, capitalism, with its stress on private or corporate profit. Curiously, and despite these divisive forces, democracy also managed to make advances during the 19th and early 20th centuries, pushing older traditional regimes out of the way. As it happened, these advances were by no means smooth or without conflict. From the beginning, democracy had to struggle against the resurgence of verticality, a resurgence promoted in part by the old regime, nobility and clergy, and more importantly, by the new industrial and capitalist elites. In this situation, democracy basically had to struggle for acceptance as a novel public regime. Against the upsurge of multiple types of inequality, it had to assert its social and egalitarian character, its task to provide for social justice and well-being, which is the source of its legitimacy. Thus, without wishing to do so, democracy had to invest much energy in combating excesses in liberalism or libertarianism, excesses which, operating in the private and social domains, threatened the public status of its regime. This is how a division arose within the ambit of democracy, between the odd partners of liberal and social or socialist democracy. A division which later degenerated into a Cold War between West and East. This is still the situation today. In the meantime, the division has been further aggravated by the transformation of traditional liberalism into neoliberalism, an offshoot marked by outsourcing and deregulation, aiming at the erasure of the public domain. The only possible solution to this conflict can come through the strengthening of democracy, especially its ability to provide for social justice and equality for all. The derailment of liberalism and liberty into radical individualism and self-centeredness is a prominent theme in discussions of the ills of Western modernity. Leading public intellectuals have contributed to these discussions, though often with the accent on the dissolution of an earlier social cohesion and less on future remedies or projects. The point has been well made by Charles Taylor, a leading expert on Western intellectual history. As he wrote in his study, Sources of the Self, The Making of Modern Identity, 1989, modern culture has developed conceptions of individualism which picture the human person as, at least potentially, finding his or her bearings within the self, declaring thus independence from the web of interlocutions which have originally formed him, her, or at least neutralizing them. For Taylor, human identity, or selfhood, can only develop and flourish when embedded in a framework of reference, a frame of socially shared meanings. As he states, we ourselves only insofar as we move in a certain space of questions, as we seek and find an orientation to the good, as the latter emerges from shared interpretation. Hence, a self can never even be described without reference to those who surround it and their shared meanings. Unfortunately, assumptions of this kind have become nearly apocryphal in modern times. What has happened, especially during the 19th century, is the emergence of certain conceptions of a highly independent individualism, which have entailed novel views of selfhood and language, bent on canceling the constitutive role of language in shared meanings. In the end, Taylor's study singles out especially two recent character types: the rational self-promoter, the ideally free ego as lucid calculator of payoffs, and the expressive self, totally ensconced in an inner subjective world and immune from outside motivations. The subject with depth is here a subject with expressive power. In his subsequent writings, Taylor further sharpened his critique of modern liberal derailments. His The Malaise of Modernity, 1991, concentrated specifically on the consequences of atomistic individualism for democracy. As he pointed out, both the rational calculator and the expressive subject are bad news for a democracy as a regime and a shared way of life. Ensconced in their ego, he writes, such people do not want to participate actively in self-government or become part of a public community. Due to the absence or destruction of shared meanings, the public realm is likely to splinter or fragment and exhibit growing polarization. Once this happens, democratic rule is liable to give way to what Taylor calls a soft despotism. It will not necessarily be a tyranny of terror or oppression as in the past. The government will be mild and paternalistic, and may even keep democratic forms, but in fact everything will be run by an immense tutelary power. In Taylor's view, the only remedy for this decay would be a vigorous political culture in which participation is valued at several levels of government and in voluntary associations. But alas, the atomism of the self militates against this prospect. A similarly pointed critique can be found in some of his more recent writings, especially A Secular Age, 2007. Apart from numerous other themes, the text also addresses the modern social malaise. In this respect, a crucial contribution consists in the distinction between a porous or open-ended and a buffered or encapsulated selfhood. For Taylor, in traditional cultures, the human self was basically porous by being open to social as well as spiritual concerns and influences. By definition, he writes, for the porous self, the source of its most powerful and important emotions are outside the private mind. Differently phrased, the porous self was inherently living socially or in a social framework. By contrast, the buffered self is shielded from and not vulnerable to public or spiritual impulses, in line with its motto, "My ultimate purposes are those which arise within me. The crucial meanings of things are those defined by me." As a result, the buffered self can see itself invulnerable as a master of the meaning of things for it. Partly under Taylor's influence, social theorist Robert Bella in Habits of the Heart, 2008, has profiled some modes of extreme self-centeredness, which in his view have become dominant in the modern and contemporary United States. Among them, two types stand out: utilitarian individualism and expressive individualism, corresponding roughly to Taylor's calculating self-promoter and expressive emotivist. The first type, at home, especially in economic and business life, analyzes everything in terms of cost-benefit, thus judging all actions or endeavors in the light of their efficiency and maximum profit. On the other hand, the expressive emotivist, ensconced in private life, judges everything on the basis of personal feelings, individual self-satisfaction, or enjoyment. Basically, what matters to the emotive self is the ability to advance private, even idiosyncratic whims or desires over social expectations and societal roles. For Bella, these two forms of American individualism are bent on elevating self-interest over social norms, and especially over frames of shared meaning and the common good. By refusing to recognize human interdependence, both foster social fragmentation and ultimately the dissolution of the social fabric. Curiously, striking a more positive note, Bella also invokes two other American traditions or character dispositions more favorable to social cohesion: the religious biblical disposition, widespread in American life since colonial times, and the republican or democratic commitment dating back to the War of Independence. While the former cultivates respect and compassion for all, especially the less fortunate, thus reining in selfishness, the second champions public liberty and the value of self-government. In his conclusion, however, Bella soberly concedes a stark asymmetry or incongruity: the relentless and unstoppable ascendance of selfish individualism over any countervailing factors which may have tempered fragmentation in the past. By privileging the ego and its inner drives, modern individualistic culture necessarily psychologizes social life, while sidelining or dismissing interhuman communication and ethical commitments. Psychologist Philip Reif, in his Freud, The Mind of the Moralist, has powerfully sketched the contours of this modern cult of the ego as a culture of the therapeutic. His chapter, titled The Emergence of Psychological Man, is particularly noteworthy for tracing the historical steps leading to the present egocentrism. According to Reif, it is possible to distinguish three main stages: pre-modern, early modern, and late modern or contemporary. Pre-modern culture was marked by its adherence to a normative moral order grounded in tradition and religion. The strength of this adherence prompts him to characterize the dominant character profile as political man. Early modern culture, with its emphasis on rational enlightenment and enlightened self-interest, produced the character type of the moderate economic man, in the sense of Adam Smith and the Scottish school. By discarding entirely any binding normative rules, late modern and contemporary society has engendered a personality type ensconced in private or buffered selfhood, a type called psychological man. Under the aegis of this latter type, all social and public problems are traced back to inner psychic traumas, requiring expert attention, what Reif, in a later text called the triumph of the therapeutic. In the end, devoid of normative interpersonal guideposts, the entire society emerges as a large sanatorium or asylum, with all inmates suffering from various pathologies, personality disorders, and forms of mental breakdown. Small wonder that in a society inhabited by shattered selves, violent insanity breaks out every so often in the form of mayhem and other terrorist acts. The degeneration of liberalism into buffered and atomistic individualism is certainly a grave concern deserving the closest attention. The issue is all the more serious as social atomism can, and often does, give rise to compensatory devices like chauvinism or ethnic collectivism. Yet despite the gravity of the situation, a caveat seems to be in order. The arguments leveled against social decay by Taylor, Bella, and others sometimes appear like indictments directed at ordinary people in modern societies. This would certainly be wrong. As it seems to me, people exhibiting narcissistic tendencies are much more the victims than the perpetrators of these derailments. Caught up in the vortex of vertical domination and social economic exploitation, such people are almost forced to seek refuge in atomistic self-interest in an effort to ward off despair. As long as leaders at the apex of modern societies present the bad example of relentless self-aggrandizement, ordinary people are thrown back on their own devices and resources, devices which are often extremely limited and confined. Thus, instead of faulting ordinary people, social and political critics must, first of all, aim their invectives against the arrogance of neoliberal elites whose conceit is liable to undermine the very spirit of democracy. In sum, if social and political leaders would soberly come to their senses, there is hope that popular common sense might also reassert itself. It is this kind of common sense, rather than grand statements on monuments or manifestos, which is the best guide toward the restoration of public democracy and the common good. There is another caveat I would like to add here. One can fully agree with Taylor and other philosophers who hold that individual lives cannot find meaning in the absence of shared frames of reference. This is the standard teaching of modern hermeneutics and a porous kind of personalism. However, how does such a shared framework arise, and when it is atrophied, how can it be restored? In the Critique of Social Malaise, I find often a merely backward-looking or nostalgic tenor, the assumption that everything was well in former times but is no longer so at present. Differently put, social harmony prevailed in the past, but dissonance rules today. Despite some evidence to this effect, the picture seems to me overdrawn and lopsided. After all, social frames of meaning do change or mutate with time, sometimes slowly, sometimes rapidly. As far as past frames are concerned, one can hardly deny the fact that they were often inhabited by social and political verticality, that is, nurtured by monarchical, aristocratic, or bourgeois forms of privilege. This means the democratic spirit of equality was present only embryonically or potentially. As previously indicated, however, there is a shift of public paradigms, which also implies a shift in language, ways of life, and beliefs. In democracy, there is a much stronger emphasis on openness and inclusiveness than was the case in the past. Inclusiveness and relationality here mean that democratic citizens have to extend equal respect and empathy to all other participants in their differences, where others include cultural, religious, and racial others. Despite all difficulties, this democratic context also generates and has to accommodate new frames of shared meaning, new idioms and linguistic tonalities, different from those of the past. Continuing this line of thought, I want to add some words on meaning and difference. As stated, democratic citizens have to extend respect not only to the sameness of others, but precisely to their difference or otherness, terms which may denote some sort of dissonance. This accent on difference and otherness has been a prominent feature in recent philosophical and literary developments, often called postmodern. In some quarters, these developments have gained a purely negative reputation as the destroyers of established meaning frameworks. Here.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?